Hello, UBS. Siobhan Chapman here. I am pleased to welcome back our UBS Asset Management Monthly Macro Podcast. Each month, we hear from the top investment professionals from UBS Asset Management's multi-asset team. Today, I am pleased to introduce Evan Brown, Portfolio Manager and Head of the Multi-Asset Strategy, as well as Fatou Conte, Multi-Asset Investment Specialist. Fatou, with that brief introduction, I'll pass it over to you.
Thanks, Siobhan. Happy to be back here again with Evan. And today, we'll discuss our latest economic views, recent developments in China, as well as how we're positioned in the MAP portfolio. So, Evan, let's jump right in. What's your take on the state of the U.S. economy?
Thanks, Fatou. You know, we continue to hum along. The data have come in pretty well, I'd say, over the last month. We've seen a steady accumulation of economic surprises, most notably on retail sales. You know, we're always most focused on the U.S. consumer. U.S. consumers in good shape. We've seen initial jobless claims, which we track very carefully as a sign of whether the labor market's really deteriorating, and those have really leveled off of late. So that's a positive sign. We've got a nascent sign of improvement in the housing market. Some housing data has been coming in a little bit better, which shows that, you know, kind of this fall in mortgage rates is beginning to have some effect on housing. But I think actually the most notable takeaway in terms of the data that we got over the last month were a set of revisions to prior data, and that being the gross domestic income data, which were revised up significantly. And the reason this is important is, one major reason is, you know, a lot of people have been concerned about the savings rate of, you know, the U.S. household being unsustainably low. It's been around 3%, which is at a very historically low level. And it was that low because income was being measured at a lower level. But after these revisions, that 3% now actually looks like it's been revised to 5.3%, which is much more normal, I'd say, and you know, doesn't send the message that the savings rate is unsustainable and that, you know, U.S. consumers are going to have to pull back significantly. It's more in line with broadly what we've been talking about, which is that household balance sheets have been and remain in good shape. So we'll be looking carefully at the jobs report we're going to get on Friday, but overall, U.S. economy seems to be headed in a pretty solid direction.
After much anticipation, the Fed actually approved its first rate cut since the start of this latest rate hiking cycle last month. So what can we expect from the Fed moving forward?
Yeah, so I think so the first thing is we kicked off with a bang, right? It was a 50 basis point rate cut as opposed to a normal size 25 basis point cut. And that was important because it sent a message from Fed Chair Powell and the broader FOMC that they, you know, first of all, they think rates are high and they see that they need to be adjusted, even though the economy is fine. Inflation has come down enough relative to where rates are that they see it warranted to you know, start off with a bang. But it's an important signal in the sense that they are prepared if they need to act more aggressively. So Powell said, you know, don't expect 50 basis points to be the new pace and we're going to get 50 basis points at every meeting. But he did send a strong message that, you know, the economy's in good shape. We plan to keep it there, and we're going big to start to send that message that is our plan. And so this is it, given the state of the economy, which is as we discussed, solid. This kind of more proactive Fed, a Fed that is determined to, quote unquote, keep it there, keep the economy in good shape, keep the labor market in good shape, is very important. You could, you know, in market parlance, you could call it the Fed put is close to the money, and the Fed has little tolerance for signs of labor market deterioration, prepared to do 50 basis point cuts if the labor market weakens faster than they expect. So, I think a reasonable base case is to be expecting 25 basis point cuts at the coming meetings. But if the labor market disappoints over the coming months, don't be surprised at all to see additional 50 basis point cuts, which is a positive.
So let's switch gears a bit and discuss the second largest economy in the world, namely China. So in the last 3 weeks, we've seen Chinese equities rally significantly. What's the catalyst behind this, and does the macro picture support a run from here?
Yes. So Chinese equities have been very cheap for a long time for all sorts of reasons. Some of them geopolitical, but the bulk of it just being a reflection of what's been a sagging economy, an economy that is undergoing a lot of structural pressures as they delever their housing market, right? And going through a process similar to Japan's housing bubble that was popped in the 90s in a long period of just dealing with that deleveraging and what people will call a balance sheet recession, having to retrench. The issue is that China's government has been very reluctant to provide a cushion while this structural deleveraging is going on, and namely a cushion for the Chinese consumer, which has is experiencing these property sector declines and is kind of entered into a deflationary mindset. Consumer confidence very low, youth employment, unemployment very, very high. And the Chinese government, I think in large part for ideological reasons, has not wanted to directly support the consumer, say the way we did in the West, right? With cash handouts or with tax cuts. That just has not been happening. What you saw in the last week, there have been kind of some improvement after the Fed cut rates, but the policy announcements really came last week, where China's President Xi and the Politburo essentially said they were finally willing to respond to the economic pressures with some urgency, and for the first time, providing direct support to the consumer, as well as trying to boost business confidence by encouraging essentially people to buy the Chinese equities themselves, right? Just lending to private investors to buy stocks, encouraging corporations to do share buybacks. So you've got direct support to the consumer, you've got direct support to the equity market, and then they've also vowed to stop the property market from declining, and so we should expect more active policy. They have an excess supply of housing, so they're trying to take that housing offline. They're just using the government's balance sheet in a much more aggressive way to stabilize the situation in China. So this is you have these kind of rare moments in markets. You can refer to, say, like Draghi's whatever it takes speech back in 2012 and keeping the Eurozone together, or Abenomics, Japan trying to engage in reflationionary policy. There's these rare moments where policymakers have just a dramatic shift and start facing the underlying problems head on in a very cheap market, and you get the kind of price action that we've seen. And so we still are waiting for signs of that the implementation, what is going to be the full size of these policies, and how will they be implemented? Are there going to be restrictions on them? That remains to be seen. But I think the language has been quite powerful, and what we've seen leaked in terms of the initial policies looks encouraging.
And what are the implications of this pro-growth stance that we're seeing in the U.S. and China on the global economy and markets?
Yeah, I mean, we just put out a macro monthly piece called "It Pays to Listen," and the point was, when you've got policymakers in the most senior policymakers in the world's two largest economies, U.S. and China, basically saying they're going to do what it takes to support growth, the Fed and the Politburo, People's Bank of China, then that's really lowering the downside risk to growth. I mean, I think both are doing so, in order to make sure their economies don't slow precipitously. So I wouldn't consider this just kind of like a big bang of stimulus. It's more to make sure that they support their economies. But that is enough. I mean, given that the global economy, the U.S. economy in particular, is humming along just fine, global economy is, there's some bright spots, there's some weak spots, bright spots being emerging market Asia, outside of China with the whole AI and tech theme, semiconductors, weak parts being Europe and manufacturing issues there. But when you've got the two world's largest economies and policymakers saying, hey, enough is enough, we don't want to see growth deteriorate from here, then that is a positive for the global economy and for markets, that they essentially know that policymakers have their back. So, we do think, this is good for overall risk assets. In particular, we thought the market got a little bit defensive, moving towards defensive sectors and the like over the last couple of months. And I think, The reaction functions from what we're seeing out of the Fed and out of China should lead to, see a bit of a rebound, further rebound into cyclical sectors from here.
Now, in terms of geopolitical risks, in recent months, we've seen conflicts between Israel and others in the area widen beyond Hamas. What risks do the recent developments in the Middle East present in terms of the economy as well as market?
Yeah, so we're definitely seeing an escalation. Proper war and escalate ground invasion by Israel in fighting Hezbollah, and yesterday seeing the missiles sent to from Iran over to Israel, and Israel vowing to retaliate. And I think we should expect a very significant retaliation from Israel on Iran, which could affect their military infrastructure, could maybe even be an attack on nuclear facilities. The thing we have to keep in mind, and we are watching it very, very carefully, we all have to do so, The channel through which these geopolitical developments matter to the economy and markets is via oil prices, right? And so, the key would be if Israel were to strike Iran's oil facilities or do anything that affects the export of oil. There's also the possibility that Iran would close the Strait of Hormuz, and 30% of the world's oil travels through that narrow passageway. Now, we view that both as possibilities, but unlikely. Certainly the U.S. and the West and Israel's allies do not want to see a spike in oil prices, and so Israel will know that. And Iran is highly unlikely to unilaterally close the Strait of Hormuz, given that they don't want kind of the full wrath of the United States and world. That would be essentially an existential threat to their regime. So So it is a, you know, it is a time of heightened risk. I would expect that we're going to see some pretty scary headlines over the coming weeks, in the sense that, you know, there will be a strong Israeli retaliation, one that's stronger than the one that we saw in April. But the key to watch is whether Israel strikes those oil facilities. We think that's unlikely, but you know, it's useful to keep a close eye on that risk.
So with that, thanks everyone for listening in. We'll see you again next month.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreement and disclosures that we provide to you about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary or ask your UBS financial advisor for a copy.